Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. At first glance, a structural engineer ensuring the stability of a 100-plus story building in the Far East would seem to have nothing in common with a translator at the United Nations. And in turn, that translator might have nothing in common with a guitar technician for, say, Radiohead. But in fact, they share one important job trait. When they do their jobs perfectly, nobody notices them. They're invisible. Conversely, when mistakes are made, catastrophe. For a concert performance, diplomacy between nations, or a building and thousands of lives. Invisibles is the word coined by writer and novelist David Zweig in his new book, Invisibles, The Power of Anonymous Work in an Age of Relentless Self-Promotion. Zweig combines research in psychology, sociology, and business to explore the traits of an anesthesiologist and an air traffic controller, or say, a cinematographer behind a big-name director and the perfumer and designer behind the latest celebrity fragrance, to get a sense of what fulfills them and, in turn, how important to an economy these anonymous workers are to us. David Zweig joins me today on Studio Tulsa. David Zweig, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This book, Invisibles, looks at certain professions in our world, in our work world, where the abilities and competencies of the person doing the job are absolutely critical, and yet they toil for the most part in relative anonymity. And that seems at odd in our sort of self-promoting world. How did you come up with this concept of invisibles, and how did you start researching them?
Yeah, I was inspired to come up with a concept and ultimately write a book on the topic because years ago, I was an invisible. I worked as a magazine fact checker for a number of years. And the thing about that job is, the better I did the job, the more I disappeared. In fact, it's only if a fact checker makes a mistake that anyone ever thinks of them at all. You know, when's the last time you read a great magazine article and thought to yourself, man, that was fact checked beautifully? You know, never. So, and here's the thing, though, that after a long day of work, and it's incredibly, you know, tedious often at times and required an extreme attention to detail. But after a long day, I'd come home and I felt a sense of reward that I didn't feel when I worked at a variety of other jobs where I was kind of secretly surfing the web half the day. There was something about this job, and I was fascinated by the notion that when I do a great job, no one's going to know. And yet, I felt really rewarded. So I wanted to dig into this further, and it seems so at odds with the culture at large, where we're told that in order to feel good, you need to constantly gain attention for yourself. And yeah. I wanted to see if there were other professionals who shared the same inverse relationship between work and recognition. You know, most of us, the better we do our jobs, the more we get recognized. So I wanted to figure out who are these people who were, the better they do their jobs, by and large, the more they disappear. In the book, I have this equation where I say perfection equals invisibility. And I found that there are people like this, not surprisingly, basically in every field of endeavor, in every industry. And I traveled around the States, I went to Europe, I went to Asia, and I profiled a number of people who are really at the tops of their fields, but who are invisibles. And I wanted to deconstruct and figure out, well, you know, how did they get there? How can it be we're in a culture where we're told in order to feel good, and also where we're told in order to get ahead that you need to constantly toot your horn, you need to raise your profile or have a platform, all these different expressions that the, you know, marketing experts use. And yet these people reach the top of their fields by essentially doing the opposite, by not promoting themselves, by simply focusing on their work. How did they get there? And that's what I wanted to explore in the book.
One of the things I really found interesting about the book, and this sheds a lot of light into a lot of high visibility occupations as well, because for take example, you being a fact checker for quite a while, the attention goes to the author of the article, the quote journalist. But really, the fact checker is doing more than just checking dates, a few. Was this chronology right? You're checking every statement, every assertion made within that article. And if it doesn't jibe with reality, that whole article goes into the, you know, the waste can for the most part.
That's right. I mean, it's really about what I learned working on this book and what these invisibles and who I profile in the book show is that we think that the greatest reward comes from gaining the most attention. And make no mistake, I am not against getting attention. It's fun, you know, being on the radio with you. I'm glad my name is on the cover of my book. So this book is not about saying whether promotion or attention is bad or not. What it is about is exploring the phenomena of people who've become incredibly successful and happen to also be really satisfied, but got there by doing the opposite of what we're told we need to do. So, and you're right, it's really working behind, oftentimes, either working behind a front man, like you said in the example of me as a fact checker, where you're really working behind the writer, or one of the people who I profile in the book is a man named Pete Clements, who for the past 20 plus years has been the chief guitar tech for Radiohead, one of the biggest bands in the world. And, you know, and this isn't a job for a 15-year-old kind of stringing a guitar in a corner. This is highly complex work when you're talking about sold-out shows in front of 20 or 30,000 people night after night, 18 tractor trailers traveling around with all the equipment, you know, enormous sums of money, millions of dollars at stake every night. This is a large apparatus. So this guy has a very, very important role. And yet his whole job is about really making someone else look great. If no one in the audience thinks of him, he knows he's done his job perfectly. He remains in the shadows, and he's happy. So that's what this kind of explores, this notion of working toward either making a front person look great, whether it's, you know, a person in a rock band, whether it's a writer, or whether it's the CEO at the head of an organization, or whether it's not about a front man, but just about the larger endeavor. That what these people show is that they are really motivated by the work itself and by making a successful end result, not about aggrandizing themselves above anyone else. And that it's a bit counterintuitive. What I found is really fascinating, both in seeing these people themselves in the book, but also a ton of research I cite in the book, is that having this attitude, and it's surprising, but that seeing yourself as a member of a team, being motivated by the larger endeavor rather than motivated by making yourself well known for doing your work, that attitude actually has a really strong correlation with success.
Now, one of the things you found as you started talking to these various people, and we'll talk about some of them here in a moment, is that they had three pretty much shared traits that you said as you were doing the interview, you were just waiting for something that would say, oh, there it is. And sure enough, it would show up. What are those three traits?
Yeah, that's right. The first trait that they all tend to share is an ambivalence toward recognition. They just simply don't seek attention the way it seems so many of us do. The second one is that they all are meticulous. And I saw it again and again with these people and this across a really disparate range of fields and industries, that all these people were really meticulous with their work. And as you just noted, you know, it's funny, it would reach a point where when I was interviewing the next person, it was just a matter of time before I heard them say, you know, and I am very meticulous. So I knew it was just this incredible organic way of finding these similarities between them. But more than them talking about being meticulous, what I try to do and what I think is really just a fun ride in the book is seeing their work, and you can really experience it with them. I'm there with Dennis Poon, a structural engineer in China at the Shanghai Tower. This is the second tallest building in the world, and we're 80 stories up, and the wind is ripping through, you know, the side of the building. There's no glass or anything up yet. And just being there and experiencing the work with these people, so you can see their meticulousness in their craft. The last trait that they all share is that they all, what I call, savor responsibility. You know, I just mentioned Dennis Poon, the structural engineer. Here is a guy who, ultimately, the safety and soundness of these buildings that he works on, really the tallest buildings in the world, that really falls on his shoulders. And these buildings cost billions, with a B, billions of dollars. They are matters of civic, even national pride. There are vast teams of workers. This is a lot of responsibility. And now, most of us, it seems, oftentimes want to avoid responsibility, or that, you know, it's seen as a burden. But for him, when I asked him, Dennis, how do you handle all this responsibility? He replied to me, it's an honor. And I just thought that was remarkable. And I saw this again and again with the Invisibles, that they viewed their responsibility as an honor. It was something they wanted to take on. And that ultimately brought them a tremendous amount of reward.
Yeah, and that was the question I asked earlier about, you know, the idea that these invisibles really shed light on the people who do get the attention. Dennis Poon was who I was thinking of, because, you know, when this tower is finished and it's, you know, a part of the Shanghai fabric of the urban community, people are going to talk about the architect. They're not going to talk about the structural engineer. But without the structural engineer, it could be a pile of rubble on the street.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, it's not a mistake that, you know, these big time architects today, that the joke name for them is Starkitect. You know, I remember after the World Trade Center fell, and I'm in New York, that there, although this was covered, you know, nationally and internationally, that they had these design competitions, and all these big names were being trotted out, and they always talked about the architect. It's this architecture firm. It's this superstar architect. They never mention the engineers. But here's a little something that most people don't know. When these big-time architects, Frank Gehry and whoever else, when they are entering these competitions and when we see their proposals and stuff in the media, that they oftentimes already have teamed up with an engineering firm. And that the engineering firm, these top people like Dennis Poon, have a really big impact not only on the obvious notion of the safety and soundness of these buildings, but also on the design and the aesthetics of the building, because the engineering is so critical when you're talking about a skyscraper. So, but Dennis Poon, he's fine with being invisible. He doesn't care. To him, the reward is in the work. And the fascinating thing is, here's a guy who is on the board of directors of a global engineering firm. He's highly compensated. He's very regarded within his field, yet the public never thinks of him. And the way he got there was by having this kind of reverse attitude from what it seems like we're told that we need to have. That, you know, whenever I asked him a question about himself, invariably he would answer "we" instead of "I." And I just thought that was incredible. And I found that many, many times with these people. Imagine someone at his stature, if anyone deserves to say, "I did this," it's him. But instead, he always saw himself as part of something larger. We as his firm, we as engineers, we as all the people working on the building.
Because all of these folks are very technical in what they do, a lot of the book is spent in trying to describe their technical expertise to you. What was it like being with Dennis Poon's in the Shanghai Tower? Again, half built, well, actually topped out, but not finished. And just watching him describe what goes into making sure that a 2,000-foot tower can handle the huge wind loads at 100 or 110 floors.
Yeah, I'm so glad you picked up on that. I mean, that to me was one of the really important parts of the book, beyond these really powerful messages about what, you know, about a path you can take towards success and toward being fulfilled. What to me really drives the book is seeing these worlds that we don't see and getting into the details. And so, right, you know, they use special wind tunnels to test the building that I think were used to test rockets. There's this special thing called a tuned mass damper, which is this giant, like, I think it was like 1,200-ton pendulum. And basically when the wind blows against the building, that kind of moves in the other direction to help stabilize it. There's all sorts of really neat stuff like that, whether it's with that, whether it's with Pete Clements, the Radiohead guitar tech, and I'm there with him literally on stage right in the shadows at a sold-out concert in Europe. I'm with an interpreter at the United Nations in a closed-door meeting of the Disarmament Council, where, I don't want to give too much away, but where a representative from North Korea basically went on a terrifying rant threatening nuclear war. This stuff was not in the press. There is no official transcript. But I'm there with these people at their jobs, these people who really affect what we see, what we smell, what we experience. So, you know, let me mention one other person where I get into a lot of details, a guy named Jim Harding, who is what's called a wayfinding expert. And this is a division of environmental graphic design, where these are the people who design the signs and systems in really complex environments like airports and hospitals or camp corporate or college campuses to help you get where you need to go. So I met with him at Atlanta's airport, which is the busiest airport in the world, and where his team worked on creating the wayfinding system in the new international terminal. And you go through and you just see how the amount of work that's spent on figuring out what typeface to use on the signs. They even do research on the type of arrow to use and where to place the arrows on the signs. And there's just all this incredible stuff. So I'm hoping when someone is done with this book, you will never enter an airport the same way again. You will never experience a concert the same way again. You will never look at a skyscraper quite the same way again.
My guest today is David Zweig. He's a writer, and his latest book is titled Invisibles, The Power of Anonymous Work in an Age of Relentless Self-Promotion. I did want to talk about Jim Harding because I'd never heard of this wayfinding. I've heard of architectural design people who basically do the same thing and signage. But what I was really interested in what Jim Harding had to say, says, we only use signs as a last resort. I thought that was really interesting. We're trying to create an environment where you intuitively know where you're supposed to go.
That's right. I mean, it's funny. I went into it thinking, okay, wayfinding, I understand what this is about. It's part of graphic design. It's about making the signs. And that is an enormous part of wayfinding. But what we don't realize is that when you're in an airport or a hospital or something, and all of a sudden you stop in your tracks and you think, you just have this sense that maybe you were going the wrong way and you turn around. Let me tell you something. Chances are it's not because you have this great internal sense. Chances are it's because there was some sort of subtle cue that you weren't aware of, but someone like Jim Harding very purposefully designed in order to get you to where you need to go. So one of the really cool things he did at the Atlanta airport is that the international terminal has a little bit of a slope on its roof. So all the signs in the international terminal and even the ones in the parking lot and the roads outside the airport leading to that terminal, all the signs have the same sort of swoop on top, kind of like a undulating curve to really echo the roof line of that area. But as soon as you leave the international terminal and you're in the domestic terminal or in one of the regular concourses, then the signs are just the standard rectangle. Now, this is the type of thing we all are probably oblivious to as we're wandering around. But when you're in the airport or when you're driving up, it gives this sense of context. So that's just one of the many kind of really neat tricks that they do to get you to flow from one place to the other without you even realizing it. Jim Harding said something really fascinating to me, you know, and he said, listen, when someone's at an airport and they get from when they check in to security to their gate and everything goes smoothly, he said, no one ever leaves a thank you note in the comments box in an airport. Hey, just letting you know, thanks, I got to my gate really easily. We're oblivious to it. We don't think about it. So for him, he said, you know, for me, invisibility really is a mark of honor that I know when no one mentions it, then that means everything's going well usually. So for him, what I tried to explore with Jim Harding and all these other people is, well, what motivates them? If they know that the public, the end user, whether it's a traveler in the airport, whether it's someone in a skyscraper, whether it's someone at a concert, whatever it may be, that what motivates these people if they know when they do their job perfectly that they're not going to get recognized by the end user? And I get into that in the book to talk about, you know, really, how do you define success? How do you really define reward? And to try to perhaps rejigger how we approach that, because I think the larger notion in our culture today really has set us on a unsatisfying path. And not only unsatisfying, but here's the amazing thing that I find really encouraging, is that the approach that these people have really seems to have a strong correlation. I think I make a really persuasive case with that when you see these successful people, that it has a strong correlation with success, that you think you have to get ahead, you have to do something one way. But in fact, these people show that that's really not the case. It doesn't have to be that way.
And you talk to a couple of employment experts and sociologists who say, we've always had this balance between what you call invisibles and the sort of star-seeking, sort of attention-seeking American psyche of get ahead and be flashy doing it. And it says we've always had this balance. And several sociologists, I think you quote, say that they're worried that this balance is getting out of balance.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, I think America has had, we've always had this duality, I think, in our kind of culture about our work ethic. You can think back to the, you know, first European settlers and this kind of puritanical nose to the grindstone mentality on up through the company man of the last century, where this is called what David Foster Wallace called the quiet dignity of the average American. And that's always been balanced out by what I call our American noise. You think of the Hollywood Klieg lights shining to the world and the gilded mansions of the gilded era, and you think of the, you know, hip-hop's bling, Elvis with his swinging hips. You know, so we've always had both, this American noise combined with this quiet dignity of just the consummate professional. But what I argue is that today I think that balance has become out of whack, as you noted, and that we are now, there's far too much focus on the American noise and people wanting attention and not nearly enough focus on just doing great work. And that both personally and culturally, we need to get back a little bit back in balance. I'm not against the notion of this wonderful vibrancy of the American culture where we have noise, but that there's something awry, and there's a whole bunch of people I quote who work in recruiting and employment stuff, and they're saying more and more people are trying to get into these fields that are very high profile, like entertainment or things of that nature, or even within certain fields, they only want the high profile positions. And there are not enough people going for jobs that are behind the scenes. And what people, you know, I'm starting to do a lot of speaking at universities now. What people don't realize is that we think that we're being almost, dare I say, brainwashed that the biggest reward is going to come from these certain types of jobs. But in fact, that what these people show in the book time and again is that the greatest reward is being challenged by your work and by taking on responsibility, and that in the end is what brings the greatest reward for people, not getting a whole lot of attention.
I was really struck as I was reading the book by a comment I read years ago. It was talking about Congress, and this was like, you know, 20, 30 years ago, that said Congress has always had a division of show horses and workhorses. Show horses were the guys that got the headlines. They made the provocative statements at a committee hearing that got them on the news or appeared on the Sunday morning talk shows. Then you had the workhorses that really tried to understand policy and try to come up with legislation that work for the vast majority of people. It says, you know, and when you look at Congress today, what do we have? A Congress full of show horses.
Right, right. Nothing's getting done. Everyone's just trying to get in front of a camera and look where it's leaving us. Yeah. And, you know, there's some really interesting research I cite in the book about where, you know, in the end, it's not even about whether you're visible or not. And that was kind of one of the surprising conclusions I had on the book about invisibles, that it's not even about how much you're seen. It's really about what motivates you. And what I found is that even some of the most famous people among us, you can think about like a star quarterback silently studying game film night after night, you know, leading up to Sunday, something like that even the most famous people among us still can embody these invisible traits of meticulousness, of being ambivalent toward recognition. It's not about saying that you don't want to be recognized, and it's not about saying that you don't at times need to promote yourself or your work. These people are not meek. They're not hiding in a corner somewhere. So I'm not saying that. What I am saying is that the people who are motivated by the work itself, who are motivated by making the larger endeavor successful, that they end up being the most rewarded, both personally and also successfully, also professionally. That there's some interesting research I cite about CEOs that are what they call transformational leaders. By the business scholars have been studying this for years, that companies who are led by CEOs who embody these invisible traits, who don't care about, you know, aggrandizing themselves, but who seem to have these invisible traits of really just caring about the larger endeavor, and they view themselves really as just a member of a team, that their companies outperform other companies that are led by these big blustery personality CEOs. What my book shows is that there really is another way, that these people offer an alternate path toward becoming successful. I'll give you a funny anecdote. You know, they did this study. I think Adam Grant out of Wharton had cited this study, that when you look at an annual report of companies, that they found a correlation between the size of the CEO's picture, or whether he included it at all, and the inverse relationship between that and the company's earnings. It won't come as a surprise then that Kenneth Lay of Enron had a full page photograph of himself.
My guest today is David Zweig. His new book is titled Invisibles: The Power of Anonymous Work in an Age of Relentless Self-Promotion. We'll save some of the stories for the book, but I do want to mention a couple. One is you follow a perfumer and a designer as they create the fragrance Unforgivable, which is a really fascinating story. But I want to leave folks with, you mentioned Peter Clements, or Plank as he's known, the guitar tech, but you also talked to another musical technician, Peter Stumpf, who is a Steinway technician. And you tell this amazing story about a particular Russian pianist who is got a pretty strong touch on the Steinway and what they were doing to make sure that the Steinway and the performer shined in the performance. And I found that to be a really interesting story. In fact, you got really deep into musical physics in the course of the story. But tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. Peter Stumpf, you know, I profiled two people who are behind the scenes in music because I wanted to highlight both the similarities but also how different they are. You know, needless to say, the environment of Radiohead's guitar tech versus that of a piano technician at a symphony orchestra are entirely different environments. So so while they're both invisibles, Pete Clements with Radiohead is really this master collaborator where he works with, you know, an enormous team, whereas Peter Stumpf, his work is essentially done alone. And right, so this pianist named Denis Matsuev, who is known as the Siberian Bear, is just this massive man. And in the classical world, he's incredibly highly regarded. Peter Stumpf is the lead piano technician for the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra, which is considered a really renowned orchestra in the country and even the world. And I follow him over several days as he's preparing the piano for the Siberian Bear. And, you know, we think that a piano tuner, if someone comes to your house, you know, yeah, but I remember as a kid someone tuning our piano, he seems like he just tuned it and then he left. But when you're dealing at the very, very elite level, it's much, much more than simply tuning the piano. There's all sorts of work that goes into voicing a piano, changing the tone, changing how the keys feel. So if you're preparing a piano for someone who really plays very physically, you then alter the touch on the keys to, you know, give that person a little bit more latitude. If you have someone who plays softer, you change that. It's extraordinary, the amount of detail and nuance. And here's the thing, listen, how many people in the audience are really going to notice these little minute details? Probably a really slim number. So what is the reward for Peter Stumpf when he is literally, there's just, the guy is, you know, I approach him, he's under the hood of the piano the way I view like a mechanic under the hood of a car. He's just in there. There's sweat, you know, off his brow. His hands are dirty and he's in there. His reward is in the work itself and that the musicians notice it. And they may not, but ultimately, people don't know that it's him. All they know is they're at a concert and everything sounds great. They're probably thinking of the performer, the Denis Matsuev, he's wonderful. Maybe they're even thinking of the acoustics of the hall. But they very likely almost never think of the piano technician. But yet Peter Stumpf had this beautiful line in the book where he said, you know, when Emmanuel Ax, that's a very famous pianist, when Emmanuel Ax is on stage and I'm sitting in the audience, I feel as though I'm having a duet with him. He said, you know, I just thought that was, I get goosebumps when I think about that line. It almost sounded crazy. But, you know, he said, listen, my name is never in the brochure that comes out, you know, for the concert series. No one thinks of me. He said, but it doesn't matter. When I'm there, I'm having a duet with that performer. That's his reward.
All right. Well, the name of the book is Invisibles. David Zweig, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
David Zweig is the author of Invisibles, The Power of Anonymous Work in an Age of Relentless Self-Promotion. It's published by Penguin. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.